Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two sponsors for you. Environments for Humans promoting their Accessibility Summit. So you can go to A11Y Summit.com. That'll get you where you need to go. That's the number of letters that are omitted from the middle of the word accessibility. Isn't that weird? It took me too long to understand that. But it's an online conference all about accessibility on the web. Going to be fascinating. And Adobe. Thanks for sponsoring Adobe. They make all kinds of awesome products for the web that you know about and maybe some ones that you don't know about, including projectparfait.adobe.com. We'll tell you about some more Adobe stuff later in the show. Let's kick things off.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to the number one numeronym podcast in America.
Yeah.
That's what, that's A11Y, is it called a numeronym?
Is that what it is?
Numeronym, yeah. And like K9 is a numeronym for dog.
Oh.
K9.
So, then that one's been around forever, right?
Yeah, I-18N is internationalization.
Oh, K-9. Not only does it work like because it's – but is it the number of letters that's omitted too? No, it's just not. In the case of accessibility,
well,
it is.
But. Usually it's – yeah, usually it's like letters, you know, or whatever. So, yeah, like – yeah, I don't know. A-16Z, Andreessen Horowitz, the venture capital firm. 1D, one dimensional space. That just seems like a shortcut.
Right. I always thought the accessibility one was weird because it's like if you don't know that, it's really not accessible. And what does a screen reader do to that and stuff? You know, I know that accessibility is more than that, and we'll get into that later. But
this is mostly like a software development thing. Like there's Mavenization for Apache Maven. So whatever, this is ridiculous. It gets a little weird. P23R, Prozes Datin Beschlagen.
I don't have it. Anyway. I don't understand it.
Number one numeronym podcast, Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyle.
Hi, everybody. I think we should just keep going. That was
just
a good
deep dive. Yeah. Yeah, numeronym podcast.
It is a rapid fire show. That means we're going to do a lot of questions. I think we're going to do the 3-minute thing. It's been a while since we've done that. The point is, if the timer goes off for 3 minutes, we just have to stop and we're going to do the next question. That way we can get to as many questions as we possibly can, even when that's frustrating.
Mm-hmm. And your job as a user, a listener, is to like just make a comment and be like, you didn't answer that question. You need to answer that question better. You didn't do a good job, but say it in a nice way. Yeah. On the other side. All right.
Let's kick things off. I'm gonna hit the button after the question is over. So you read it, or I'll read it just because then I'll get the rhythm here. Matt right, Tyus yeah. asks, I need to recommend a responsive, or I think he's asking for a recommendation for a responsive image solution for a redesign of a website running on .NET. Epicerver CMS. Looking at the various solutions out there, it seems to me as if there's picture fill, but that might not work because Matt is in a situation where there's lots of legacy content that are just using image tags and he wants to be responsive with those too. So like a back polyfill, you know, like wants to go back in time with this solution and not necessarily have to update content. Two, the adaptive images, I think it's adaptiveimages.net solution, may not work because it works with basically HTAccess and PHP, neither of which are things that .NET has. And that one is interesting because that would work with old image tags because it intercepts the request for the image and processes a new one and replaces the image that's served up and stuff. So it's kind of a cool version for legacy, dealing with responsive images in a legacy way. So Matt says, what responsive image solution would you use under those constraints? It also seems like we need to support browsers down to IE8 and no JavaScript browsers. Click in the timer.
So what I'm going to say is it depends on how you templated things. You know, if your users can just write in image tags like through a WYSIWYG or whatever, like those are probably just going to not be responsive. So you're just going to have to max width that and just, I mean, basically if you can't do anything like for all your legacy content, you're probably just going to do nothing because you're doing nothing right now. So that's what I would say there. But if you have the ability to edit the generation of the image, I think picture element, like the actual picture element, would be your best bet, because that will have no JavaScript fallbacks, IE8 fallbacks, just through the image tag that it requires, because it's like picture source image closed picture. So it has a image element in there, but then modern browsers will just.
So your solution is do all your new content with picture fill or something, and don't worry about the old content.
Yeah, well, I mean, the old content won't have the new sources, right? Or right. The media query points, so they'll basically just default to the old image, the original image. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say.
That's totally legit, I think. I would also say if ignoring old content just isn't a possibility, like you need to handle responsive images for older content, like that's the only acceptable outcome, which is legit because performance matters, of course. Find some way to do what Adaptive Images does, but with .NET. You know, like just because you don't have htaccess or whatever doesn't mean there's some way for your server to intercept requests for image requests. Like figure out some server level thing, which when your server is asked for a .jpeg, .ping, or .gif to respond and do some processing of some kind. Maybe you can like send it over to a PHP server and use the Adaptive Images script that you can like have a little server set up just to do this particular thing, or intercept it and funnel it through one of those third party services like Resource or whatever it is, .it or something like that. Like just be like, oh, I see, this is a request for an image file. I'm going to take that URL that is being asked for and then preface it with a resource URL so it does the processing of it and returns the proper thing. There's some cool server level thing you can do.
Oh, and I was gonna say adaptiveimages.com over there. There is a C#.NET port by David McDermott.
Well, there you go.
That would probably be my choice if it has parity with Matt's?
Yeah, Matt Wilcox.
His Adaptive Images, which hasn't been worked on for 2 years, which I should say, that's maybe a sign that either it's feature complete or not being used. All right. Next question is an audio question, and I preloaded it this time because I'm a winner. Here we go. All right.
Hi, guys. I have a question about website optimization, and perhaps also it's linked to WordPress. I'm a freelance developer, and I've built a range of different sites now, mostly on WordPress. And in each case, when I've finished a site in WordPress, I felt that once I pushed the site live, the load time was a bit sluggish, upwards of 3 or 4 to 5, even then when things were really slow, 7 seconds. I know that there are many factors that can cause slow load times, things like large number of HTTP requests, blocking scripts, overly large CSS, and a whole number of things that one can do wrong when building a site. But one thing I've also noticed is that when, for instance, I inspect the load times in the network tab of Chrome's developer tools, that very frequently it's the very first line, the one that lists the URL of the page, that is using up so much time, sometimes as much as 2 or 3 seconds. So my question is, am I right in understanding that this first line in the network tab of Chrome's developer tools signifies the server's response time? And if so, why might this be so slow? 2 to 3 seconds seems quite slow. I'm also saying this has something. It might have something to do with WordPress, because I recently built a site using a file-based PHP CMS called Kirby CMS, which is actually a very nice framework, and it does not seem to have this problem. the server response times for that project, were, meaning that first line, were generally under 1 second. In general, I found this problem of website optimization pretty difficult to understand and tackle. So I'd love to know how you approach the problem, what kind of resources may exist out there to help, both educational and in terms of analysis of a specific website. I know about things like Google's Page Insights and use that regularly, but it doesn't seem to address this issue of server response. Thanks.
All right, Ethan has the WordPress blues. Chris?
Yeah, okay, yes. The first line is your server response time. And if that's 2 to 3 seconds, that's pretty bad, I would say. I'm in that same boat with a WordPress site. But CSS Tricks is really, really big, and there's a lot of – the database is really big, and I try to do what I can. But a lot of times, like, that response time is just 2 to 3 seconds for me, which sucks but is true. I would think – but it's usually never not that fast on, like, a small WordPress site, like just a blog or whatever. I feel like the WordPress is a lot faster that way. But it's not for every single user that uses CSS Tricks, because that time comes from PHP processing and database requests and stuff, and those things never happen when you use a caching plugin. In the case I'm using W3 Total Cache, then that server response time is really quick, in the hundreds of milliseconds time, because all it is just asking for a static HTML file, which the server is very fast at serving up. So look into some caching to get that time really slow. And then remember, when you're testing the performance of your site, to not do it while you're logged in and caching is off, but do it, you know, anonymously or whatever, because that's more important than you using your own site. It's nice when you using your own site is fast, but it's more important all the other people that use your site. So, you know, if we're focusing just on that, definitely that first request is the server. Also try to, what is that the most popular software ever for analyzing your server's performance? Shucks, that you just throw it on there, you know, and it does. New Relic.
New Relic.
Yeah, New Relic is awesome. I think they have a free-ish account for a small thing that you can use to figure that. So if you're trying to dig into that 2 to 3 seconds to find out where it comes out, yes, that's the server, but New Relic will tell you why on your server. Was it a slow query, or is it PHP that's slugging around but your database is fine? And figure out stuff about that. Like, maybe it's just your database is all screwed up and that's the slow part or something, and it needs to be optimized somehow. But anyway, what are you thinking?
I was going to say, like, you want to definitely investigate a caching layer. Like, your number, W3 Total Cache is a good example. Like, it will minify all your JavaScripts into one file. And then, basically, your site only needs a non-cache hit every, you know, depending on how often you post, but it's usually, like, never or like once a day it needs a non-cache hit, right? Or something.
Well,
like,
if you have, it depends on how active comments are.
Yeah, if you have an active commenting system, maybe it's 90 seconds, but okay, but blah.
Sorry.
I guess just
cache it,
and you're going to be 90% of the way there.
Yeah. You're good.
And then can I do one more fact? The number of, like, WordPress loops you're doing, like if you're doing, like, WP query or git posts or something 400 times, that's going to slow you down.
Caching should still help that, though.
Caching should fix that. So,
All right. Chris Hallahan asks, any tips for avoiding merge conflicts in the compiled .css file when working in Teams? Should I even push compiled CSS to the repository, or should this be one person's responsibility? Dave.
Never commit the compiled CSS. That's my rule of thumb. I mean, there are situations where you want to. I think we do it on Shop Talk, you know.
Right, because we just push everything that's pushed.
Yeah, but we also, like, work on Shop Talk, like, once a year. So, right. Like, the chances of us merging.
If you want to not compile your CSS, that means something else has to compile your CSS when you push it to the server. Like if you're in the Rails land or whatever, part of your deployment process will be running a bunch of stuff, you know, and compilation of assets will be one of those things that run. So it doesn't really matter if you commit your CSS files or not. In fact, you pretty much don't, you know.
Yeah. There's like a I came across like a front end git ignore file or something, and maybe it's, yeah, here. Okay. So it's like DS store files, Graffle files, whatever. Oh, that's not the one. But like you can find them on GitHub, like just kind of search around or whatever. But like you never want to check in your Sash cache. You never want to check in even like Bower components or node modules and stuff like that. Don't send those back and forth because
they can be the enormous and not useful. Yeah. They have to pull them anyway.
Yeah, like you have to update that anyway. So you just have to put in part of your workflow with your other designers that you are like, oh yeah, when you pull, then you compile. Like you have to pull before you compile all every time. And then, and then you're going to probably have to have one person that deploys the builded files out to like the production server. I think Jekyll's a good example of this. So, like you work in SAS and then it makes a site folder and that's your website and that is the thing that you deploy,
right? But you might be pushing compiled CSS in that situation. But you know what's cool is I think they just GitHub just released that the GitHub pages now will build for you, so you don't have to or for whatever you just commit the SAS and it does the compilation of assets for you. Which is pretty cool.
How handy is that?
It's very handy. And I should say, if you are having merge conflicts, though, you know that you have the right version of the SAS, right? So your built.css files win. So if there's a merge conflict, just say resolve as yours copy, because your copy is right. Because if the SCSS is right, then that's right. So just like it sucks that you got a merge conflict, but just don't dig into it to find out why. Just be like, I win, push mine.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the best. Hey. All right, cool. Next question. Near and dear to my heart, Shay Bungie writes in, what software do you guys recommend when testing websites through a screen reader or text-based browser? It would be good to see what experience people who use those methods receive on websites you build. Go.
Click the timer here. Yeah, I don't know much about this. I only heard about it about a week ago, maybe, but there's a thing called Chrome Vox. And I think, is it a browser plugin or is it an entire software download?
It's a Chrome extension that is a screen reader. So
you can use from the comfort of Chrome, you can do this type of thing.
Yep. And once you turn it on, it is on, buddy. You can't, you have to like disable the extension like turn it off. But Chrome Vox is really awesome. Chrome Vox has a really nice tutorial on how to use Chrome Vox, which gives you kind of a idea of how like screen readers are used. If you're on a Mac, VoiceOver is really easy.
Does that not work in Chrome? Is that why? Because it only works in Safari, or does it work in Chrome too?
No, VoiceOver works in Safari too, or Chrome and everything. Mm. So a screen reader, it's weird, right? Like a screen reader is not browser related. It actually sits like in between, like it sits on the OS level, you know, like. And so it's the browser's job to announce things to the OS that can announce things to the screen reader.
Interesting.
If that
makes
sense.
But is Chrome Vox more browser integrated?
Yeah, Chrome Vox is actually based for Chrome OS, like it's tool for Chrome OS. But because Chrome OS is always HTML, CSS, JavaScript, or whatever, it's
sure.
Like,
but so it doesn't do any better at navigating a browser accessibility wise than anything else does, though, right?
Nope. It's pretty like just, it's just a different way of getting around.
So what if you're like Windows or Linux or?
There's like JAWS. NVDA is an open source screen reader built by some guys in Australia who are blind, but definitely worth checking out. But Chrome, if you're on a Mac or iPhone or even like you can just, on a Mac it's Command Shift F5 and you're in VoiceOver then. And like, just start hitting the tab button and you'll get through web pages and like put your mouse away and just try to drive around. It's a pretty humbling experience. Another thing you can do is if you're into Chrome extension called Chrome Accessibility Tools or Google accessibility tools. I think it's Chrome accessibility tools. But it, in your web inspector, there will be under the elements panel, you know, you have styles, computed, event listeners, DOM breakpoints, properties. It adds a thing for accessibility properties. And it also adds in your audits tab an accessibility audit. It's top notch. It'll tell you, it has like a little face. It says text. And then there's a little face next to what is the, like what it is going to read out basically. It basically like tells you this is what a screen reader is going to say. So,
cool. Yeah. Well, that's that.
That would be. Can I get the right name? Is it Chrome Accessibility Tools? Chrome Accessibility Extensions. Nope. Frick.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Accessibility Developer Tools. I'm done. All right. Next question.
Speaking of accessibility, the Accessibility Summit, literally go to A11YSummit.com, is coming up from Environments for Humans. It is a two-day online conference. That's from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., both September 9th and September 10th. You can attend one of those days or both of those days, depending on how much time you have, what's of interest to you, and that kind of thing. You can attend this conference from anywhere in the world with an internet connection. And some speakers, I guess, because you need to hear people talk because they're talking live at this conference. 2 days, Accessibility for UX by L. Waters here, HTML5 accessibility, PDF accessibility. That's pretty interesting. How often do you think about that?
Yeah.
Low-cost accessibility tools, you know, really interesting diversity of speakers speaking at this thing. iOS and Android accessibility, stuff about ARIA.
ARIA Gone Even Wilder by Jared Smith, which is, I'm actually very interested in this. It's kind of like you can do ARIA and then if done correctly, it's great. But if you did it badly, you like made your page inaccessible, which is
awesome. You can screw it up. It's not like because a lot of us have the feeling that, I used an ARIA roll. Where's my back patter?
I'm a champ. Mm-hmm. I'm the internet's best friend, and I feel like that. But and then that's what makes me angry about accessibility is like it's like you try to help and you didn't. And so anyway, we can
Falling in Love with Forms by Aaron Gustafson. Lots of stuff here. So sign up for the accessibility conference. Pick your day or go both days. This came up on us quick. We don't have a coupon code for it yet, but I assume it's going to be Shop Talk or Shop Talk Show. Hit up Environments for Human on Twitter and ask. You know, I can't guarantee that there is one because we're working ahead of them a little bit. Sorry, Ari and Christopher, but we love you and the Accessibility Summit is going to be rad. You should go to it. Let's do another question.
All right. Next question comes from Nader Dabbit. Writes in, I've seen a few tutorials using Adobe Edge Animate to create CSS animations and wanted to know the thoughts of the Shop Talk Show about this software. Is it something that needs to be learned or looked into if I haven't, or if I already have a working knowledge of CSS3 animations and transforms? Is it something for beginners? Is it a tool to create even more complex animations that may be harder to hand code? Chris,
full disclosure, this just came in unrelated, but we also have Adobe as a sponsor sometimes, and we have Adobe as a sponsor this episode. So, and they specifically said when they asked the sponsor, mention Edge Animate. So this is just serendipitous and nice, but
do so know, I think it's great. Yeah.
Adobe Edge Animate is awesome though. Go to creative.adobe.com/products/animate. We'll link it up in the show notes, but it is a super duper robust timeline editing tool for CSS animations. Now this has been tackled a number of times and I've seen people try and fail to do this, but Adobe Edge Animate is still doing that and doing a good job of it, it seems. So like this is the one. Like if you are a creative professional type person and you want to work in a UI to make animations, this is probably your best bet, you know? And it's not like I know how to do CSS animations. I'm just going to do it in the code. Yeah, that's fine. In most animations I've ever done in my life, I work directly in the code too, but they generally end up simpler that way. I think if you're going to, there's a certain type of person in the there's certain things that UIs are good for. And I think this might be one of them at a certain level of complexity. And it opens up the world of animating to people that, I don't know, they just aren't as comfortable in code. You know, there's tons of people that are just wickedly creative who prefer learning a little bit of user interface and don't feel like smurfing around with the code, you know?
It's also, it gets into like I can like make flip books using pencil, post-it notes and a pencil. Why do I need software to make a cartoon? Right. You know, it's like this thing is, they're a sponsor or whatever. So my opinion is totally biased, but I would use a tool like this if I was doing a lot of animation on a daily basis. If I'm just trying to like move a div like across the page, I know how to do that. But if I'm like trying to get like seven things to animate and have a feeling like at the same time, kind of flash style stuff, I would use this
tool. Right. There's layers, sure. There's drag and drop, there's nudging things around with your mouse and the keyboard, and which layer goes on top of other layers, and all that stuff is handled in a UI. I think as soon as it gets a little more complicated, and Dave, you have it exactly right. You move a div across the page, fine. You need to move two divs in tandem, fine. You start to like have a timeline that matters, and let's say it's repeating, and where does it stop and where does it start again, and does the ending make sense with the beginning and stuff? That stuff gets totally mind-bending with code. For example, I was working on I wanted to do a timeline SVG animation. I have Wufoo as a sponsor on CC Strix. I'm like, I'm going to make you a cool animated ad, and the letters from Wufoo like pop up and down, a little dinosaur peeks up his head, and then he goes down really fast, and then it shows like the three words of their slogan, Wufoo slogan on there. Things are fading in and out, and I got it done, and I chose to do it in code, but it was mind-bending, and I feel like it may not be like as good as it would have been if I was working on it in a visual tool. I might redo it and try out Adobe Edge Animate just because, I don't know. I think I could get there. So the question from, what was it, Nader?
Yeah, Nader.
Was should I try this tool? Yeah, totally try this tool. Yeah, it's.
I think, yeah, like, is it, yeah, I think give it a whirl. I'm sure, like, your like proof of concept, like move a div across the page, you'll be like, ugh, I can't do it. But if you're like going to make Spider-Man animation, then you're probably like, oh, wait, this is actually really great.
There's so, more of this coming to the web. You know, I mean, the day is coming where we won't see animated GIF ads. All ads and stuff will be like this. All little interactive features will be using stuff like this.
Well, that's what I thought, like, immediately. If you're, like, working on advertising, you know, and you're doing flash banner ads or whatever, bless your heart. But this would be the perfect place
to move to. Not to mention being comfortable for someone moving from flash.
Right, right,
exactly. Okay.
Yeah, 3-minute mark. That's great. Here we go. Alex Policastro writes in, hi guys, love the show, always listening while I'm at work. Good, I'm in a bit of a pickle. Rutro, I am trying to dig into SAS, SCSS, preprocessors, and have learned a lot already about using command line with Grunt and Compass, but I'm wondering if CodeKit would be simpler and easier thing to learn first. I know the command line is the way more pro way of doing things, but I don't know if it is too much for me to learn right off the bat.
Click.
Thoughts?
We've talked about this a bunch before. So even on the one where we had the Compass or the, we've had the Compass fella on, but we've had Brian Jones on and Guy from CodeKit as well, and they fully admit that CodeKit is a simplification of all these tools, and it's just a really easy one and remains to be powerful. But like, if you already know Grunt and Compass and are happy with that workflow, that's fine. Yes, CodeKit would be easier, but it's going to be a switch as well. I just feel like you need to use Grunt when you need to use Grunt. You need to use Grunt because you want to make SVGO a part of your workflow, or you want to use SVG Store, or you want to use like one of the hundreds, if not thousands, of grunt plugins that do very specific things that CodeKit doesn't offer you. Or, you know, and of course, it gets more complicated than that, too. Like, what if you have a team that doesn't want to buy CodeKit for all its users and you want to, you know, have the configuration of it shared, although you can do that in CodeKit, too, these days. But, you know, you just want to have, like, grunt as just part of a thing. Like, a user goes, you know, git pull origin master, npm install grunt. You know, and they're running with your dev environment essentially because all they had to do was just pull some stuff and go. That's the reason to use grunt, you know, complex situations and setup and stuff. Whereas CodeKit is just, you know, it's more for the lone rogue, I would feel like. Like, I just want to use all this technology, but I want it to be easy as pie.
Mm-hmm. I would say personal experience, I mean, tools like CodeKit and Scout and all that, that's how I got into pre-processing, just because it just made sense. It was like, oh, I just point this thing at a directory. Wonderful. And I actually knew the command line. I knew how to do all that stuff, but I just was like, I don't want to like type out file names and just hope I did that right or whatever. So, So CodeKit made it easy for me. It bridged that gap. But, and then I was able to get my whole company on it. Like, everyone at my company can, my 3-person company, can, you know, compile SAS or Compass with, whatchamacallit, with like CodeKit. But I'm not saying it's, I guess it's not a but, like, there, for me, I want to do other things like lint my JavaScript and, something else like, maybe deploy my website from my command line. That's why I'm starting to use grunt and gulp and stuff like that.
Exactly.
And then instead of like having to fire up CodeKit and then fire up grunt, I'm just like, well, I'll just make grunt do my CSS instead.
So, it's always a little bit more complicated than you think, getting a grunt file or gulp file set up just how you want it to. Be like, every time I start to use it on a project, I'm like, this will be easy. I'll just, you know, I'll have grunt do this stuff real quick. And that's fine, and it's not particularly hard, but I always find it takes like, you know, it always takes me like a good 4 hours, you know, to get my grunt set up just perfect. And I get a kick out of it.
Right.
But it's still, it's a commitment. Whereas with, you know, with CodeKit, you just drag and drop a folder on there and away you go. All right.
Next question. Neil Hainsworth writes in tab index. Subject, tab index. A scenario. A website has a off-canvas type navigation with the hamburger space menu toggle. Navigation is hidden, visually hidden, but remains in the DOM for, say, screen readers and offline users. When you tab through the site focus, it disappears as if it navigates through a list of links and leaving the user in no man's land. What are some best practices when using tab index?
Click.
Well, first of all, you should attend the accessibility summit. That would be my first suggestion.
I always heard one of the best practices of using tab index is don't use tab index.
Exactly. That's actually the thing is you don't. So tab index was kind of invented back in the early 2000s or maybe 90s even as a way to be like, oh man, we made accessibility really terrible, by using all these tables, right, for our forms. So let's just use tab index to fix it. And everyone was like, yeah, the tab index, it fixes it. And then now it's like no one uses it, right? So it's terrible. The only time you want to use tab index is when you want to like make a div tabable, like for whatever reason, you need a div to be focusable, by the browser. And in that situation, you'd want to use tab index equals 0. Taking a step back, if you can avoid that, that's awesome. Like button elements and link elements, those are already focusable by the browser. They already are in the tab index thing, the like list of things it can go through. In your case where the off-canvas menu is gone, and then but like you're leaving it available for screen readers, like that's okay. And I know it, like that's good that you're doing that, but there's kind of this thing too. It's like if you hit it for users, like sighted users, why aren't you hiding it?
Exactly. I think this is like some accessibility dogmatism coming into play here. And it's that, of course, they're in the DOM, right? But they can still have display none on them and still be in the DOM. And then they're just hidden and you can't tab through them because they have display none on them. But display none gets like a, you know, and I have articles about this too. Be very careful with display none, because once it does have display none on them, you cannot tab to them anymore. But you're not, in this case, you're not making them impossible to tab to. You just are making it so that you have to go to this menu thing first, activate it, and then you can tab through them. So it's kind of like this idea that, like, people are so scared of using display none that they do something where they don't do that. They just kick them off the page. And then you're in that situation that you described, Neil, where you're tabbing through stuff that's way off the page that other people, that you can't see, and it's confusing as to where you are and stuff. Maybe just don't do that. Like, leave them in the DOM, of course, because they're on your page, but just display none of them instead of doing the kick off the page thing. And when you toggle that menu on, then they become tabbable through. And when you toggle that menu off, then you can't tab through them anymore. Now, it feels like I'm being very strong about this advice, and I should back off a little bit because I don't know that much about this stuff, but that seems reasonable to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just treat all users the same. Anyway, hopefully that helps. Also, sorry, one thing. Just think of somebody who tabs through the site too, like somebody with one finger or something like that. You know, when they try to tab from menu and they hit tab, they have no idea where they're at, you know? So there may be some focus things you want to, like, auto bring in the menu, but, like, that's up to you. But like, just imagine somebody who only has one finger and has to tab through.
There is an excellent post. Did you read that A to Z post on?
Yeah, Pastry Box.
Yeah, let's get the proper attribution for it. I hadn't.
Pastry Box A accessibility A to Z. An alphabet of accessibility issues by Ann Gibson. Yes,
thank you, Ann, for writing that. It's very good, and it really drives home the accessibility isn't just screen readers thing, and it's not just the blind or deaf or colorblind or whatever. There's a million things that fall under the thing of accessibility. And it's like, you know, somebody broke their hand and they're trying to use the internet one-handed, things like that, just to think about, you know? Like, it's not saying that, like, you better stop everything and start using your website one-handed to have sympathy for this. Like, but maybe, you know, maybe try some of these out, you know?
Yeah, they're like, it's like 26 personas that you could consider, sure. You know? One of them is like C. It's really sad, but it's like C has blood cancer. She's been on chemo for a few months, and basically she has chemo brain, which it means like she's drowsy, you know, less smart feeling than she used to be, you know, and she's just worn out, you know, like, so anything, you know, if you're making it harder to use for somebody, like, you just have to avoid that best as possible. Like, quit being so clever. Stuff like that. I think it feels it's a good article. So we'll post a link in the show notes. How's that sound?
Sounds very good. Dylan Dixon, boom, writes in, where would you recommend a young web designer start off? Let's say they know HTML and CSS and are looking to learn a bit more to kick off their career. What would you recommend? I feel like we have a soundbite for you, Dylan.
Just build websites.
That's right.
Excellent!
We got nothing more for you, man. You just got to do the work. Do the work, son, and you'll be fine.
Yeah, do work. Make friends. Kick off their career. I mean, you probably need to go to meetups and meet people and talk to people. That would be a good thing, too. So I think the idea, because I guess if you're a young web designer, you might not be able to go to bars, but go to conferences and meet people and just say, like, hey, I'm a junior level guy. I would love to know more. I know some stuff, but I'll work. And then they'll hire you. It'll be perfect. Go ahead. Next.
That's pretty good. So we have Adobe as a sponsor. I already mentioned that, and we talked about Adobe Edge Anime because somebody wrote in about that. That is definitely a tool that they have available. Of course, they're the makers of Adobe Photoshop and which I'm sure we all use for all kinds of things because it's a pretty good design tool. Adobe Illustrator, which is awesome for working with specifically on the web, SVG. In fact, I don't know if all of you know this, but you can copy and paste inline SVG out of Illustrator. So if you're like, I need a little bit of inline SVG, you can go into Illustrator. And I think this might only work in Creative Cloud Illustrator. But anyway, you just like you go download something from the Noun Project and you got an SVG file and you like open it up in Illustrator and you like mess around with it, change the colors, adjust the like perhaps the canvas size around it, the artboard, and you get it just how you want it. Just select that thing and just hit copy and just go out like into some HTML and just hit paste and it'll be inline SVG of that icon there. I just feel like that's like a nice feature. Thanks for adding that, Adobe Illustrator. But they also make all kinds of little tools. You know, there's so many tools that they built. Just this tiny little beta one that probably, I don't know, we've talked about it here on the show a little bit before, but you might not even know about it. It's one called projectparfait.adobe.com, which takes your PSD files and it'll open them right in the web browser. And then you just click around on stuff and it gives you CSS and colors and fonts and allows you to export cropped versions of the little assets in there. And we'll tell you when those fonts match up with fonts that are available on Typekit and all kinds of stuff like that, which is pretty cool. It's a little bit like CSS Hat. That's like a Photoshop plugin that can do that, only it's like free and in the browser. So
from Adobe.
Yeah. So CSS Hat is cool too, but this is like just a one that happens right in the web browser. So pretty cool. Thanks, Adobe, for sponsoring. You do good stuff for the web. Thank you for doing that.
All right. Rob Gilbert writes in, I know there's a performance hit for every new font that gets loaded, but once I have loaded a font, is there a performance hit based on how much text is on the page for said font? My boss likes, blame it on the boss, Rob. My boss likes to use web fonts for the H tags, then use fallback web-based fonts for body copy. Is this necessary?
That's a good question does if you're using a custom font, the more text that's on the page, is there a penalty for? I don't know. I mean, I would think not. I guess
I don't think so. I mean, we're talking microseconds, right? I think at that point.
I guess it just depends on how complex the font is, but that would matter whether it's a custom font or not. So whatever.
I think the big thing is, so web fonts, when they're loading, like the second it sees a font face and knows that that font exists, it requests the file, right? It says like, oh shoot, I need Open Sans from the server. So then when it's going to get Open Sans from the server, it's like, cool, let me erase all the font places where that font's applied, because I know I'm going to apply it later. And so it's then just blink. And so then you're waiting a minimum of 500 milliseconds or whatever it takes, 300 milliseconds to like go get that web font from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And this is on your first page load. So then there's a chance the user will just see no text for a little bit.
I just on CodePen, you can go to look at it now. I moved the custom fonts to the bottom just because I was literally on a flight and they were blocking and it was annoying. So I moved them to the bottom and you can totally see a nasty fout, but the time to page is a lot faster. So I'm like, oh, what do I do now? You know, like, I like that it's faster, but I hate the fout. So I just don't know what to do. I'm honestly, these freaking days, I'm so annoyed at fonts. I'm just like, well, I'm just going to move back to friggin' WebSafe fonts.
I went to WebSafe on my body copy for the reason your boss gave. It's kind of like if web fonts are going to take a penalty, maybe it's not worth blocking reading, you know, like the base function of your blog or what, or your website.
That's a pretty good idea. And you know what the side benefit of loading just headers is? That you probably only need one variant of the font for headers, whereas for body copy, you probably need bold and italic and probably maybe even bold italic, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing too, is you're not, but then again, it's like, H tags are the scannability of your website. So do you want to penalize the scannability of your website? Like, is anyone blogging about this even? I don't know. For me, in terms of like first page load versus multiple page loads, and Chris, maybe you have a different experience on your sites, but it's like for me, I more or less have to optimize for a single page load. Like on my sites and my clients' sites, it's like not everyone's going to every page in the website or even multiple pages. Sometimes it's like one page, like an article page, and then it's like there, they read, they bounce, you know? So maybe there's, I don't know. Is it even worth it? I tend to not talk in multiple page views too often.
But. Yeah. All right. Well, that's all we got. I think I forgot to hit the button on that.
Oh, shoot. All right. Well, next question. Got another one from Neil Hainsworth.
Oh,
twofer. Yeah. You win. Here we go. How do you guys handle email accounts? I used to use my main email account for all my addresses, and shortly after an attack on a certain famous tech company, I received huge waves of spam that has been a struggle to get rid of. Do you sign up with email account that you can quickly dispose of as spam gets out of hand? Or if so, do you even check these accounts? Are there any tips for linking to an address that can prevent spam bots getting to your address, i.e. at my website or something.com? Although this is annoying for users. Chris, I imagine you would get a bit of spam.
Yeah, I don't actually, because I just use Gmail and thus you get no spam, you know? Like, I don't know. Some get through, of course. You know, there might be three or four that I ditch every day or whatever. And then, you know, depending on how bad they get, you can, like, find keywords in them and just make a filter that says if that keyword's there to automatically spam it. I don't do anything special. I really don't. And I think that seems weird that you're just getting buried with spam. It makes me think that you probably don't use Gmail, which is fine. There's plenty of people that don't like relying on Google, and Google spies on you and yada, yada, yada. I actually just don't care. I'm on the like whatever Google bandwagon, and maybe I'll regret that someday. But it's been a lot of years now, and nothing bad has really happened to me as far as I can tell. Although I'm sure some people might point to the times I've been hacked and be like, "See," but there, I don't think there's a ton of evidence that it was Google's the problem. In fact, I have two-factor authentication on my email accounts. And
used to host our email. We used to host our clients' emails like on our server, and dude, spam was a nightmare. So we switched everyone over to Google Apps on ours, and then we just made our clients do it. And you know, it's like whatever $10-$20 an email address or something
that.
They charge money, but man, it's just worth it. Like, how much time can you save by reducing spam like 99.9%, you know? That's my thing, is like, that's worth $15. That's worth $1 million, really. But anything else that you'd want to do is like a service. One thing I do, and I don't know if this is smart, but I heard about it, right? Is if you sign up for a website, let's say Shop Talk Show. You sign up for Shop Talk Show. You can do whatever Dave, because Dave Rupert, that's not my real Gmail, but whatever. Dave Rupert, you're emailing some stranger now. Let's quit doing that. And then you can do plus Shop Talk Show. And that plus is like, it's a Gmail feature where it tags that. Like, and for me, it leaves like a paper trail of who is farming out my email address, basically.
Right. And then you have to remember to log in with that, though, which can be obnoxious, but
which is tough. But I use 1Password, so bingo, bingo. But that to me is pretty cool, because it's kind of fails sometimes. Like, they're like, you can't log in with a plus sign, and I'm like, dang it.
It also provides you a filter in the future too, because you'll get spam to that probably.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, oh, look, Shop Talk Show sold my email address to whatever, Viagra.com, jerks. And then you can sue us. Don't email that.
Oh, good luck, Neil, with your email woes. We have one here from Matt Quirk.
Oh, shoot.
I've got a bone to pick with Lynx and a seemingly odd trend of not adding target underscore blank or making a conscious effort to load external links in the same window or tab. Or conscious effort to load external links in the... I don't know what he's saying. Over the past year and a half, I have encountered this trend in an ever-increasing frequency, and I am curious as to why. I can only think of two reasons for actively choosing to send me away from the site in the middle of content. One, the perceived idea that at the point of interaction, I am no longer of value, so if I leave the site, it's not a big deal. And or two, the ever-growing and expanding mobile landscape is giving the impression or that has been shown in data that people dislike a new tab or open window on their phone. So it sounds like Matt likes this idea. He likes that if you're sending me to a link that isn't your page anymore, like if I'm writing a CSS Tricks article and I link to a CodeRops article, that it should open up in a new tab or window. But as we know on the web, you need to, that's not the default behavior. You have to add an extra attribute to your anchor links in order to make that happen. And Matt's, I guess, wondering why people would be so lackadaisical that they don't do that, I guess. What do you think about that, Dave?
So I think that I'm actually maybe on the opposite side of the fence from Matt. I think target blank is maybe aggressive, and you should only use it like in super small circumstances, if at all. I think like you could. I mean, for me, it's like any person who does a lot of tabs and stuff like that, command click or whatever will open it in a new tab, right? Or control click.
Yeah. And I would say that because you can't just say people know how to do that, but if people really like it, they do know how to do that. And the fact that it's the default behavior of links doesn't have that, that means that on the web, 99% of links don't have that. So that people are already used to that behavior. So like you changing it for your website because you like it, well, that's fine, I guess. But it like realize that that's a change in default behavior and you're doing it for you, not anybody else.
Yeah, that's my thing is that never assume what the user wants to do. You know, like if the user wants to open a new tab, they can just command click. They have control of that feature, right? But me just assuming, oh, in this circumstance, they want a new window, you know, like the CodeRops or CSS Tricks to a CodeRops article example, it's like that they probably were done with your blog, you know, like for Absolutely. Every one person that wasn't done, you know, six were.
I even get guest posts once in a while, and if they specifically put a target as blank, I'll remove it. I think It should never be targeting people's blank unless, you know, like you said earlier, there's some extreme circumstances that makes that user experience clearly much better. It's not just a preference at this point, but it's preventing something bad from happening. I have an article about this, but there's a couple ones I can think of right off the bat. And one of them we use here on Shop Talk with a little JavaScript, which is if you came to a Shop Talk page and you've clicked play on one of our podcasts to listen to it. Now, if you click a link on our page and they didn't have target blank on them, the podcast would stop playing because the page is unloading and it ditches all that stuff from memory and the MP3 player stops. That's annoying. You've explicitly played our podcast. If you want to stop it, you should probably stop it, you know? So I'm thinking it's usually a mistake if you click a link on a page after you've started playing something like that. So we don't. We have a little thing in place that opens up the links in a new tab. That's a pretty extreme situation. As soon as you hit stop, the links go back to normal. We use it once in a while on CodePen, like if you have unsaved data in a pen and you click away from it to like go to the documentation or something, it's like, why do we want to bug you and be like, do you want to save? You know, instead we're just like, no, we'll just target equals blank that so you can't get away from it. So mostly, Matt, I guess we disagree.
Yeah. And there are, like, again, there are reasons, and I think blog about them, like why you think it would be good, you know.
But anyway, we have time for another one, I think.
Got one more from, let's see, Pierre Lemoine. You may be aware of this already, but if you export Adobe Illustrator file to SVG, you can choose to save the layers as metadata in the SVG file. Interesting. What's even more interesting is that you can target those layers with CSS and jQuery. Even more interesting. Essentially, you can traverse the Illustrator layer stack in an SVG file and add things like hover events, which change the layer color via CSS. It's something I've researched in the past with the goal of applying it at my workspace. This isn't my site, but here's a tutorial on the subject. I guess that wasn't a question. That was just a handy link to a site on skills with a Z design.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. But I think we basically know this, right? It's you can only do what Pierre is talking about if you're using inline SVG, which is what I talked about with the copying and pasting out of SVG, or essentially using the SVG syntax right in HTML. And Pierre's right. If when you're saving an Illustrator file out of SVG, for example, if you've named the layers, the layer is it's either going to be a path or a polyline or polygon or line or one of the, I don't know, 10 or so shapes that you can draw in SVG. And that path will have an ID on it of what you named that layer, which is pretty nice. Or if it happens to be that layer was a group of paths or whatever, ended up being, that'll have a G tag around it and that will have the ID, however that works. And then when you're using inline SVG, that's in the DOM. So that's, you're right, Pierre, and that you can change the layer color of stuff, you know, by targeting that ID or targeting it in some other way and applying things like fill and stroke to it through CSS and its ability to be targeted through JavaScript as well. It gets a little trickier when you use the use element because there's a shadow DOM boundary there, but there's still some ways to do it. And yes, that's pretty dang cool, isn't it? SVG is cool.
Pretty darn cool. In terms of SVG versus Canvas, this seems like the one of the big things. Like, this is already... you have to write an app that draws in SVG, right? In Canvas, but in SVG, it's kind of grunt versus gulp, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, both have APIs and stuff, kind of, or it's not even really. Like, SVG is a file format, and Canvas is a set of APIs for drawing.
Right.
So you can draw with SVG, but you just do it with JavaScript. You know, you just to manipulate things how you would manipulate anything else. But Canvas has specific stuff, like draw a line or whatever the heck the Canvas syntax is. They're different. You know, Canvas doesn't have a file format.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. But with Canvas, you can, do a real quick save as PNG.
You can. You can indeed, yeah.
But, I don't know. I think it's a... I don't know. I think it's... Yeah, this post, I went to it. Guys, it chokes. This is why you got to go over your blog post from 2011. Yeah,
there's some unescaped code or something that died.
Yeah, but I think the first two paragraphs are relevant to what Pierre was saying. I don't know, man. I think it's pretty cool. I also like that, copy the layer, Command C or whatever, and then Command V as SVG text. That's so killer. Oh, I love it. All right. Well, Chris,
I think we did good. Let us know how you think about the short format. I think we just like to switch it up from time to time here. We haven't actually made this survey yet, but me and Dave were talking about a survey and sending it out to you just because we want to know. It's been a while since we've reached out to find out, I don't know, do you guys like ShopTalk, or what's your favorite parts about ShopTalk? What would you do if we switched it up? Yeah. I mean, we're not going to ask that. We're going to ask more hard-hitting questions, I think. But
yeah, what
we want to keep things interesting around here. I feel like if we just do the same thing forever, you're going to get bored. So let's switch it up, and we'd like to switch it up in the direction of ways that you would like us to switch it up, I guess.
Yeah. So there you go. You guys.
You.
Potatoes.
We like you guys.
Shop Talk. You guys are the best. awesome. Well, thanks everyone for listening to another Rapid Fire episode. episode. Be sure to follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. Go vote us up in your podcatcher. And yeah, you should, if you're not following us, follow us. It's probably too late, but we've probably already tweeted about this feedback survey. So you should follow the feedback survey there. And Chris, do you have anything?
ShopTalkShow.com.